the Lord of the world and his assistants of the higher degrees occupying bodies formed of etheric matter. 5. It was decided about 17 million years ago, the coming of the hierarchy and the founding of Shambhala being about 18.5 million years ago, to have on the dense physical plane an organization and a headquarters for the mysteries, and to have a band of adepts and chohans who would function in dense physical bodies and thus meet the need of the rapidly awakening humanity. 6. The first outpost for the Shambhala fraternity was the original temple of Ibiz, and it was located in the center of South America, and one of its branches at a much later period was to be found in the ancient Maya institutions and the basic worship of the sun as the source of life in the hearts of all men. A second branch was later established in Asia, and of this branch the Himalayan and southern Indian adepts are the representatives. Materially changed. At a later date than the present, discoveries will be made revealing the reality of the old form of hierarchical work. Ancient records and monuments will be revealed, some above ground and many in subterranean fastnesses. As the mysteries of Central Asia in the land stretching from Chaldea and Babylon through Turkestan to Manchuria, including the Gobi Desert, are opened up, it is planned that much of the early history of the Ibetsan workers will be revealed. We might here note the fact that the word Ibez is literally in the nature of an acrostic, veiling the true name of the planetary logos of the Earth, one of whose principles is working in Sanat Kumara, making him thus a direct incarnation of the planetary logos and an expression of his divine consciousness. These four letters are the first letters of the real names of the four avatars on the four globes of our earth chain who have embodied four of the divine principles. The letters I, B, E, Z are not the true sensar letters, if such an inaccurate expression can be used of an ideographic language, but are simply a Europeanized distortion. The true meaning is only conveyed at the fourth initiation, when the nature of the planetary logos is revealed and his four avatars are definitely contacted through the direct mediatory work of Sanat Kumara. 7. A word now as regards the work of the Ibetsan adepts and their mysteries. It is necessary here to point out that the whole trend of their work was in a way different, and necessarily so, to that of the adepts at this time. Their objective was to stimulate mysticism and the stimulating of the kingdom of God within the human atom. The nature of their work is most difficult for the average man of this time to comprehend, owing to the different state of his consciousness. The Ibetsan adepts had to deal with a humanity which was in its infancy, whose polarization was most unstable, and whose coordination was very imperfect. There was very little mentality to be found, and men were practically altogether astral. They functioned even more consciously on the astral plane than on the physical, and it was part of the work of these early adepts, working under instruction from Shambhala, to develop the energy centers of the human unit, stimulate the brain, and make him fully self-conscious on the physical plane. Their objective was to bring about a realization of the kingdom of God within, and little attention was paid, in their training of their disciples, to the bringing about of the realization of God in nature or in other units. It was necessary in those days to employ methods more definitely physical than are permissible now, and these methods of physical stimulation were employed, and the laws of energy, as they worked through the various centers, were taught, until the time came when another big change was made in the hierarchical methods, and the door from the animal kingdom into the human was closed, and the door of initiation was opened. It was felt at that time that man was then self-centered enough and individualized enough to permit of a drastic change in method and practice. All this took a vast period of time, and it is the remnants of the earlier temple practices which have come down to us in degraded phallic teaching, in tantric magic, and the practices of hatha yogis. The infant humanity of Lemurian and early Atlantean days had to be taught what they were by means of symbols and methods which to us would be crude, impossible, and of a nature which the race should have transcended for many millions of years. 8. At the time the door of initiation was opened, many millions of years ago, the lodge came to two decisions. that individualization must cease until man had not only coordinated the physical and astral bodies and could think self-consciously, but until he had also transcended the physical and the astral. When he is becoming group conscious, then the door into the kingdom of self-consciousness will again be opened. That the path of mysticism must lead eventually to the occult path, and that plans must be made to impart teaching, and mysteries must be organized which would reveal the nature of God in all that is seen, and not only in man. Man must be taught that though an individual, he is but part of a greater whole, and that his interests must be made subservient to those of the group. Gradually, the teaching was reorganized and the curriculum increased. Little by little, the mysteries were developed as the people became ready for them, until we have the marvelous schools of the mysteries of Chaldea, Egypt, Greece, and many others. 9. Three things might be mentioned. A. The relatively low point of evolution of many men and their naturally physical polarization. B. The work of the black adepts and the followers of the left-hand path. When the Ibetan adepts, again under instructions from the masters at Shambhala, began to withdraw into the temples to make the mysteries more difficult of attainment and to work against abuses and distortions, a number of their erstwhile followers, many of great power and knowledge, fought them, and thus we have one of the causes of the appearing of black and white magic, and one of the reasons of the purifying waters of the flood being deemed necessary. See, the powerful thought forms built up in the early Ibetan mysteries, and which, particularly in America, are as yet undestroyed. This gigantic dweller on the threshold of all the true mysteries has to be slaughtered before the aspirant can pass on. 10. The work of the Ibetan adepts and the mysteries of the Temple of Ibez are still persisting and are being carried on by the masters and adepts in physical incarnation throughout the world. They teach the meaning of the psyche, the ego or the soul, and of the human unit, so that the man may indeed be what he is, a god walking on earth, his lower nature, physical, astral, and mental, completely controlled by the soul or the love aspect, and this not in theory, but in deed and truth. When this is the case, the physical body will have no lure for the real man. The emotional nature and desire body will no longer lead astray, nor will the mind shut out that which is true and spiritual, but the God will use the three bodies as vehicles of service to the race. Then will the human kingdom be transcended and man pass into the spiritual kingdom, there to have further lessons, just as infant humanity, when passing out of the animal kingdom, was trained and taught its functions and work by the Ibetan teachers. In Atlantean days, the goal that the hierarchy of teachers set before themselves was the awakening in man of the love nature as a step towards the awakening of the heart center. To do this, the teachers at that time were themselves focused, deliberately and of intent, in the heart center, and chose to work entirely through that center, subordinating their mental equipment and the mental energy they could use to the need of the time. They kept their mental force in abeyance when training the initiates until the time the third initiation was reached. In our race, the condition is reversed. The hierarchy is working now entirely on mental levels, though basing all endeavor upon past achievements in connection with the heart center. Up to the third initiation, therefore, disciples have to endeavor to work entirely with mental energy in an effort to control, master, and use it. Their attempt is concentrated then upon transmitting, from egoic levels, the will aspect of the soul. That will has to be imposed upon the personality until it has become the automaton of the soul. Then the intuition takes control, and energies from the intuitional or buddhic plane begin to make their impact upon the form nature, the personality. Prior to this period of intuitional control, there are many lives lived wherein the intuition may begin to play its part, and the student learns the meaning of illumination. Until after the third initiation, however, it is the illumined mind which is the dominant factor, and not the pure intuitive perception or pure reason. After this great initiation, which marks a definite transition out of the form consciousness, the initiate can function at will on the plane of the intuition, and the mind is steadily relegated into the background till it becomes a part of the instinctual apparatus, as much a part of the subconscious instinctual nature as is the instinctual nature which the materialistic psychologist so much stresses. Intuitive perception, pure vision, direct knowledge, and an ability to utilize the undifferentiated energies of the universal mind are the main characteristics of the Aryan adepts. I use the word undifferentiated in the sense of freedom from multiplicity. Certain main distinctions will still be found to exist. The will of the soul, regarding that soul as having its place on one of the seven rays, is superseded by the will of the whole. These are words meaning but little, or having at best only a theoretical significance to students in this group. When I say to you that the will, which is transmitted through the medium of the controlled mind, is embodied in seven types of energy, and to these seven types there are corresponding types of humanity, you say doubtless that that is clear and not so difficult to grasp. Yet do you indeed understand? Seven types of energy and seven types of responsive mentalities dependent upon the seven ray types. In this statement, we note the differentiations of the soul aspect as grasped by the mind. These are the seven differentiations which take the place of the multiplicity of differences into which the form aspect falls. They are, nevertheless, distinctions and differentiations, and persist in their hold over man until the third initiation. By them, he is swept into certain major activities and life tendencies according to his particular ray. These are mental distinctions. All souls on the mental plane take the forms of the solar angels of the divine sons of mind. Hence we have these groupings, and hence the focusing of the energies through which the plan of the ages works out through seven main departments. At a later stage, when certain great transitions in consciousness have taken place and the form has lost its hold, even these divisions disappear, and the plan is seen as a whole. The life is known in its essential oneness, and the term monad begins to have some real significance. Students must always remember that all distinctions and categories are mental productions and are due to the modifications of the thinking principle and to the control of form by mental energy. As the central thinker of the universe works through the power of thought, the problem of surmounting these distinctions and differences is well nigh insuperable until such time as the aspirant comes under complete control of the second aspect of divinity and passes out of the domination of the third or matter aspect. But up to the third initiation, even the second aspect, the aspect of love, implies duality, for it is inherent in love itself. Ever there is the lover and the loved, the desirer and the desired, the seeker and the sought. It is only as the first aspect, that of energizing, unifying life, which sweeps all forms and all dualities into one great synthesis, is sensed at the third initiation that the words I have here dictated convey any practical meaning or realization. Let us simplify matters, if we can, by three clear statements. In them, we will sum up the work the disciple accomplishes as he struggles with and masters the energies of the mental world. 1. Work on the mental plane produces a realization of duality. The disciple seeks to blend and merge the soul with its vehicle, and to do this consciously. He seeks to fuse them into a unity. He aims at the realization that here and now they are one. The unification of the self and of the not-self is his objective. The first step in this direction is taken when he begins to cease identifying himself with the form and recognizes, during this transitional period, that he is a duality. 2. The mind, rightly used, becomes therefore a recorder of two types of energy, or of two aspects of the manifestation of the one life. It records and interprets the world of phenomena. It records and interprets the world of souls. It is sensitive to the three worlds of human evolution. It becomes equally sensitive to the kingdom of the soul. It is the great mediating principle in this interim of dual recognition. 3. Later, the soul and its instrument become so unified and at one that duality disappears, and the soul knows itself to be all that is, all that has been, and all that will be. There is a curious and ancient Atlantean chant, which is no longer used, but in those far-off times was chanted by the initiate who took the third initiation, the consummating initiation of that period. It goes as follows. The translation of the symbols in which it was written necessitates the loss of rhythm and potency. Quote, I stand between the heavens and earth. I vision God. I see the forms God took. I hate them both. Naught do they mean to me, for one I cannot reach, and for the lower of the two I have no longer any love. Torn I am. Space and its life I cannot know, and so I want it not. Time and its myriad forms I know too well. Pendant I hang betwixt the two, desiring neither. God from high heaven speaks. There is a change. I hear with ear attentive, and, listening, turn my head. That which is visioned, yet visioning could not reach, is nearer to my heart. Old longings come again, yet die. Old change with clamor, snap. Forward I rush. Myriads of voices speak and halt me in my tracks. The thunder of the sounds of earth shuts out the voice of God. I turn me on my forward path and vision once again the long-held joys of earth and flesh and kin. I lose the vision of eternal things. The voice of God dies out. Torn again am I, but only for a little time. Backward and forward shifts my little self, e'en as a bird soars into heaven and settles back again upon the tree. Yet God, in his high place, outlasts the little bird. Thus do I know that God will victor be, and later hold my mind and me in thrall. Hark to the joyous paean that I chant. The work is done. My ear is deaf to all the calls of earth, except to that small voice of all the hidden souls within the outer forms, for they are as myself. With them I am at one. God's voice rings clear, and in its tones and overtones the little voices of the little forms dim and fade out. I dwell within a world of unity. I know all souls are one. Swept am I by the universal life, and as I sweep upon my onward way, the way of God, I see all lesser energies die out. I am the One. I, God. I am the form in which all forms are merged. I am the soul in which all souls are fused. I am the life, and in that life all little lives remain. Close quote. These words, chanted in the ancient formulas on peculiar and selected notes, were most potent and brought definite results in certain ancient ceremonies that have long since died out. To the three concise statements above made, we might add a fourth as follows. 4. When the citta, or mind stuff, is swept into activity by abstract ideas, the embodied thoughts of the divine mind carrying the energy of their creator and consequently the cause of phenomenal effects in the three worlds, and when to this is added divine understanding and synthetic apprehension of the will and purpose of God, then the three aspects of mind are unified. These we touched upon earlier and called them 1. Mind stuff or citta, 2. Abstract mind, 3. Intuition or pure reason. These have to be unified in the consciousness of the aspirant. When this has happened, the disciple has built the bridge, the antikarana, which links 1. The spiritual triad, 2. The causal body, 3. The personality. When this is done, the egoic body has served its purpose, the solar angel has done its work, and the form side of existence is no longer needed, as we understand and utilize it as a medium of experience. The man enters into the consciousness of the monad, the One. The causal body disintegrates, the personality fades out, and illusion is ended. This is the consummation of the great work, and another Son of God has entered into the Father's home. That he may go out from there into the world of phenomena in order to work with the plan is probable, but he will not need to undergo the processes of manifestation as humanity does. He can then construct for the work his body of expression. He can work through and with energy as the plan dictates. Note these last words, for they hold the key to manifestation. Our study of the energies which have been brought to our attention as we studied Rule 10 has brought us to a consideration of personality energy emanating from A, coordinated man, B, dominant human beings, C, groups such as 1, the hierarchy of adepts, 2, the integrating group of mystics of the New Age. This will be an important consideration. This group of mystics is gaining each year in potency. Planetary energies emanating from A, the 7 planets, B, the Earth, C, the Moon. Only a few things can be noted about this section of energies and about the next, for this is a series of instructions for the aspirant and not a treatise on energy. Solar energies emanating from A, the physical sun, B, cosmic sources. In all thoughts concerning these energies, it should be remembered that they are passed to us through, or rather constitute the bodies of, certain lives whom we call the devas, in their greater and lesser groups, and that therefore we are all the time working in the bodies of lives, and hence influencing them. Some of you, therefore, who have made a study of a treatise on cosmic fire, may find it of value to note the following items of information. 1. The lowest types of devas or builders on the evolutionary path are violet devas. Next come the green, and last of all the white devas. These are all dominated by a fourth and special group. These control the exoteric processes of physical plane existence. 2. It must not be forgotten, however, that on a lower scale of the evolutionary ladder are other groups of lives, wrongly entitled devas, which work in obedience to the law and are controlled by the higher entities. There are, for instance, the denser forms of gaseous life, termed often salamanders, the elementals of the fire. These are directly under the control of the Lord Anyi, Lord of the mental plane, and in this mental age we have the element of fire entering into the mechanics of living as never before. Eliminate the products which are controlled by heat, and you will bring our civilization to a stop. You will bring all means of transportation to an end and all modes of lighting. You would throw all manufactories into the discard. Basically, again, these fiery lives are found in all that burns and in the warmth that holds all life formation on Earth and causes the flourishing of all living things. 3. Under the law of correspondences, the mental plane has an analogy in the third subplane of the physical plane, the plane into which science is now entering. Mind has, for its main expression in the material world, what we call our scientific civilization. 4. Anyi rules on the mental plane and has domination likewise on the third subplane of the etheric planes. He is the lord of the fifth or mental plane, counting from above downwards, if one must employ these terms for the sake of symbolism. For this world cycle, Anyi is the dominating influence, though Indra, lord of the buddhic or intuitional level, has a subtle control which is steadily waxing stronger. All humanity is striving towards the fourth plane of union between the three higher and the three lower. But at this present moment, the plane of mind, or of fire, is the most important. 5. We need to remember that just as in particular incarnations, men are focused or polarized in various bodies, sometimes the astral and sometimes the mental, so at this time one might infer that our planetary Logos himself is focused in his mental body. He, it has been said, is striving towards the fourth cosmic initiation, which makes possible our attainment of the fourth initiation, for he carries us forward with him, and on our particular level, we achieve as cells in his body. 6. As time progresses, Indra will swing into control, and the age of air will be ushered in. More and more, as the Buddhic principle manifests and at one-ment is achieved, shall we see this age of air coming into being. A corroboration of this can be seen in the gradual control by men of the air. In an esoteric sense, all in the future will become lighter, more rarefied, and more etherealized. I am choosing my words with care. 7. Our God is a consuming fire. Refers primarily to Anyi, the controlling factor in this age. The Devas of the Fire will play an increasingly important part in all Earth processes. To them is given the work of inaugurating the new age, the new world and civilization, and the new continent. The last great transition was governed by Varuna. 8. Agni controls not only the fires of the earth and rules the mental plane, but he is definitely associated with the work of arousing the sacred fire, the Kundalini. Note how the correspondence works out. A great part of the fifth root race, three-fifths perhaps, stand close to the probationary path, and with the coming in of the new age and the advent of the Christ in due time and in his own place, note the care with which I express this, dogmatic assertions in terms of men's concrete minds are inadvisable. Many will find it possible to make the adequate extra effort entailed in the taking of the first major initiation. They will begin to pass from the fifth to the fourth plane. The Lord of Fire will achieve his peculiar work for this cycle by arousing the fire of Kundalini in the large numbers of those who are ready. This will be begun in this century and carried forward actively for the next 1,000 years. In your work, you may later be shown, all depends upon your aptitude, methods of approach to these dominating forces, but this will come subjectively and not through magical work and formulas. The attainment of a right vibration will work automatically in the production of right conditions and right rapport. I would again point out that we shall not waste time in planetary intricacies and the interplay of solar energies, but will concern ourselves with the laws of practical spiritual living. I seek but to give a few thoughts which have relation to the coming age, and which will enable man to go forward to that glorious heritage which is his, and into which he must inevitably enter under the good law and through the experience of rebirth. Through rebirth, he learns to dominate and utilize form correctly. All forms in themselves are not expressions of a personality. To warrant the term, three types of energy must be present, three types fused, blended, and coordinated into one functioning organism. A personality is, therefore, a blend of mental energy, of emotional energy, and of vital force, and these three are masked, hidden or revealed, note this terminology, by an outer shell or form of dense physical matter. This outer crust is in itself a form of negative energy. The result of this union of three energies in an objective form is self-consciousness. Their fusion produces that sense of individuality which justifies the use of the word I and which relates all occurrences to a self. Where this central conscious entity exists, utilizing the mind, reacting sensuously through the emotional body, and energizing the dense physical via the vital body, then one has a personality. It is self-conscious existence in form. It is awareness of identity in relation to other identities, and this is equally true of God or man. It is a sense of identity, however, which persists only during the creative process and for as long as the matter aspect and the consciousness aspect present the eternal duality of nature. In our evolutionary development, it is not realized in the subhuman forms. It is realized in the human kingdom and is realized but merged into and negated by the greater forms and consciousnesses which we call the superhuman. Personality is that state of awareness which has its conditioning factor in the mind stuff, but this can be transcended when that mind stuff no longer controls. As the individual mind stuff is an integral part of the universal mind, and as the principle of mind is inherent in all forms, the sense of individuality and of self-awareness is always eternally possible. In the higher states of consciousness, it is, however, eventually relegated to a subordinate position. God, for instance, can always and eternally be aware of that reality which constitutes the self, and which governs the integrity of the solar system, and of the solar interplay with other systems. But the consciousness of divinity and the awareness of the solar deity is not primarily occupied with selfhood. That, as a result of past world periods and experience, lies below the threshold of the divine consciousness and has become as much a part of the cosmic instinctual nature as are any of the human instinctual attributes. The focus of the eternal attention, if I may use so unusual a phrase where words are necessarily almost worthless, lies in realms of awareness beyond our comprehension. They lie as far beyond our ken as the awareness of a master of the wisdom lies beyond the ken of an ant or a mouse. It is therefore fruitless for us to dwell upon it. For us, there is the achieving of personality, or of a full registration or awareness of the indwelling self. There lies, then, the utilization of that personality and its sacrifice eventually to group good, with a consequent merging of the self in the one self, and the fusion of the individual soul, consciously and willingly, in the oversoul. I am, the cry of every human being. I am that, the cry of every personality who realizes his selfhood and uses his personality in order to express the will of the indwelling entity, the true person. I am that I am. The cry of the individual soul as it is lost in the whole and realizes its oneness with the soul or self of all. The characteristics of the individual who is beginning to function as a personality might be briefly enumerated as follows. They are simple and clear and preeminently selfish. Let it not be forgotten that the primitive step on the way to selfhood, of necessity, is selfishness. Let it be equally well remembered that the prime hindrance to the advanced and highly evolved personality is selfhood, or the prolongation of the selfish attitude. The characteristics, therefore, are, in their sequential development, as follows. 1. The ability to say, I am, I wish, I desire, I will. 2. The consciousness of being in the center of one's tiny universe. Around me the heavens move and the stars in their courses revolve, is the motto of this stage. 3. The sense of drama and the capacity to visualize oneself as the center of one's environment. 4. The sense of responsibility and the aptitude to regard the surrounding members of the human family as dependent upon one. 5. The sense of importance, the outgrowth of the above. This demonstrates in power and influence where there is a real and steadily awakening entity behind the persona and in braggadocio and bombast where a small, selfish creature functions. 6. The power to use the entire equipment so that the mind and brain function synchronously and the emotional nature is thereby subordinated, inhibited, or controlled. This involves a steady growth of the power to use thought. 7. Capacity to live a coordinated life so that the entire man functions and is guided by purpose, expressing the energy of will, by desire, expressing the energy of the emotional or psychic nature, and by vitality, which swings the physical vehicle into line with purpose and desire. 8. Power to influence, sway, guide, and hold others within the range of individual purpose and desire. When this stage has been reached, the three energies which constitute a personality have been successfully fused and merged, and the mechanism or instrument of the indwelling self is a usable and valuable asset. The man is a potent personality and becomes the center of a group. He finds himself to be a focal point for other lives and is an influential, magnetic individual, swaying others, coordinating human units into groups and organisms. He becomes the head of organizations and of parties, of religious and political bodies, and of nations in some cases. Thus do the dominant personalities come into being and find themselves. They discover thus the distinction between the center of power, the self, and the equipment. They finally become conscious of vocation in the true sense of the term. It should be noted that this sequential development is paralleled by an inner growth of soul awareness, though the mode of expression of that inner growth is largely dependent upon the ray upon which the spiritual entity is found. One point should be here noted, and upon this point aspirants should exercise care. The usual connotation of the words spiritual growth is largely that of religious growth in understanding. A man is deemed spiritual if he is interested in the world's scriptures, if he is a church member, and if he lives a saintly life. But this is no true definition, for it is not sufficiently comprehensive. It has grown out of the impress set upon human thought and terminologies by the Piscean Age, and through the influence of the sixth ray and the work of the Christian Church, all most necessary and all inherent in the great plan, but which, divorced from their eternal context, lead to the overemphasis of certain divine expressions and the overlooking of other as vital manifestations of the divine consciousness. The true significance of the words spiritual growth is far wider and more inclusive than their manifestation through the medium of religious and mystical literature and organizations for the imparting of metaphysical truth. Power, purpose, and will are divine qualities and expressions and show themselves with equal clarity through a Mussolini or through a Pope. In both cases, the mechanism of expression modifies and steps down the qualities and serves as a handicap. A potent personality may function in any field of human expression, and his work will warrant the word spiritual just insofar as it is based on high idealism, the greatest good of the largest number, and self-sacrificing endeavor. These three, idealism, group service, and sacrifice, are characteristics of those personalities who are becoming increasingly sensitive to the soul aspect, the qualities of that soul being knowledge, love, and sacrifice. This is why the emphasis in all schools of true esotericism is laid on motive. People who are strongly individual and are developing a group consciousness inevitably in some life find their way into esoteric schools and have to be guided in such a manner that the soul nature enfolds, overpowers, and uses the personality. The outstanding characteristics of those personalities who are not as yet soul-centered or controlled are dominance, ambition, pride, and a lack of love to the whole, though they frequently possess love for those who are necessary to them or to their comfort. You have, therefore, in the sequential development of humanity, the following stages. 1. That of the animal consciousness. 2. The emotionally polarized individual, selfish and governed by desire. 3. The two above stages, plus a growing intellectual grasp of environing conditions. 4. The stage of responsibility to family or friends. 5. The stage of ambition and of longing for influence and power in some field of human expression. This leads to fresh endeavor. 6. The coordinating of the personality equipment under the above stimulus. 7. The stage of influence, selfishly used and frequently destructive, because the higher issues are not registered as yet. 8. The stage of a steadily growing group awareness. This is viewed A. as a field of opportunity, B. as a sphere of service, C. as a place wherein sacrifice for the good of all becomes gloriously possible. This latter stage puts a man upon the path of discipleship, which includes, needless to say, that of the earlier phase, probation or testing. The problem consists in ascertaining upon which step of the ladder and in which phase one finds oneself at any particular time. Behind each human being stretches a long series of lives, and some are now headed towards the stage of dominant selfish personality expression and are making themselves individuals in full conscious awareness. This is for them as much a step forward as is discipleship for all of you. Others are already personalities and are beginning to experiment with the energy flowing through them and to gather around themselves those people who vibrate to their note and for whom they definitely have a message. Hence the myriads of small groups all over the world working in every known field of human expression. Others have passed beyond that stage and are becoming decentralized from the personality expression in the three worlds of human life and are motivated by an energy which is the higher aspect of the personality energy. No longer do they work and plan and struggle to express their personalities and to make their individual impact upon the world or to gather magnetically around themselves a group of people who look up to them and thus feed the springs of their pride and ambition and who make them both influential and important. They are beginning to see things in a newer and truer perspective. In the light of the whole, the light of the little self fades out. Just as the light that is inherent in every atom of the body is gathered together and obliterated in the light of the soul when that blazes forth in all its glory. When this stage of selflessness, of service, of subordination to the one self, and of sacrifice to the group becomes the objective, a man has reached the point where he can be received into that group of world mystics and knowers and group workers, which is the physical plane reflection of the planetary hierarchy. The new group of world servers. We have spoken often of the integrating group of knowers who are beginning to function upon the earth, gathered together in loose formation and held by the inner spiritual tie and not by any outer organization. The planetary hierarchy has always existed, and from time immemorial and right down the ages, those sons of men who have fitted themselves for work and who have measured up to the requirements have found their way into the ranks of those who stand behind the world evolution and guide the destinies of the little ones. Their grades and works are theoretically known, and names of some have been given out to the masses, at what cost and personal sacrifice those masses will never know. With the hierarchy of adepts, I do not propose to deal. The books upon the subject are easily available and should be read with the needed reservations as to symbolical interpretations and the limiting effects of words. An event is, however, transpiring upon Earth which is, in its way, as momentous and as important as that crisis in Atlantean times when the physical, vital, and astral bodies were coordinated and formed a functioning unit. Then the yoga of devotion, or bhakti yoga, was initiated for the training of the aspirants at that time. A physical plane replica, as far as such a replica was then possible, was organized of those who could work devotedly and who could learn, through the use of ceremonial and pictures, some mode of activity which would carry on the hierarchical work on Earth and thus constitute a training school for those who later would be admitted into the ranks of the hierarchy. The remnants of this Atlantean group remain with us in the modern Masonic movements, and the work of the hierarchy was thus perpetuated in sign and symbol. There has thus been preserved in the consciousness of the race a pictorial representation of a momentous planetary condition which worked out in the human family in this threefold coordination, but it was primarily objective. Form and symbol, tool and furniture, temple and tone, office and externalities were the prominent factors. They veiled the truth, and we have therefore preserved the outer and visible form of an inner and spiritual reality. Only those were, in those days, allowed to participate in these mysteries and work who felt within themselves the longing and desire for the mystical vision, and who loved deeply and were devoted to the spiritual ideal. They were not required to possess active mentalities, and their intellectual powers were practically nil. They liked and needed authority. They learnt through ceremonial. They were devoted to the great ones whose names and forms stood behind the office holders in the exoteric lodges. Mind entered not in. This must be remembered. There were no personalities. Today in the world, another great moment of crisis has arrived. I refer not to the present world condition, but to the state of the human consciousness. Mind has arrived at a functioning power. Personalities are coordinated. The three aspects of man are being blended. Another formation or precipitation from the hierarchy of adepts has become possible. On the physical plane, without any exoteric organization, ceremonials, or outer form, there is integrating, silently, steadily, and powerfully, a group of men and women who will supersede eventually the previous hierarchical effort. They will supersede all churches, all groups, and all organizations, and will eventually constitute that oligarchy of elect souls who will govern and guide the world. They are being gathered out of every nation, but are gathered and chosen not by the watching hierarchy or by any master, but by the power of their response to the spiritual opportunity, tide and note. They are emerging out of every group and church and party, and will therefore be truly representative. This they do not from the pull of their own ambition and prideful schemes, but through the very selflessness of their service. They are finding their way to the top in every department of human knowledge, not because of the clamor they make about their own ideas, discoveries, and theories, but because they are so inclusive in their outlook and so wide in their interpretation of truth that they see the hand of God in all happenings, His imprint upon all forms, and His note sounding forth through every channel of communication between the subjective reality and the objective outer form. They are of all races, they speak all languages, they embrace all religions, all sciences, and all philosophies. Their characteristics are synthesis, inclusiveness, intellectuality, and fine mental development. They own to no creed save the creed of brotherhood, based on the one life. They recognize no authority save that of their own souls, and no master save the group they seek to serve, and humanity whom they deeply love. They have no barriers set up around themselves, but are governed by a wide tolerance and a sane mentality and sense of proportion. They look with open eyes upon the world of men and recognize those whom they can lift and to whom they can stand as the great ones stand, lifting, teaching, and helping. They recognize their peers and equals and know each other when they meet and stand shoulder to shoulder with their fellow workers in the work of salvaging humanity. It does not matter if their terminologies differ, their interpretations of symbols and scriptures vary, or their words are few or many. They see their group members in all fields, political, scientific, religious, and economic, and give to them the sign of recognition and the hand of a brother. They recognize likewise those who have passed ahead of them upon the ladder of evolution and hail them teacher, and seek to learn from them that which they are so eager to impart. This group is a product of the past, and upon that past I will touch. I will also indicate the present situation and forecast somewhat the general lines along which their association and future work will run. That such a group is forming is true and holds a good augury for the coming decades. In quiet and subtle ways they are already making their presence felt, but theirs is as yet primarily a subjective influence. Let us begin with the past. About the year 1400, the hierarchy of masters was faced with a difficult situation. As far as the work of the second ray was concerned, which had to do with the impartation of spiritual truth, there had come to be what I might call a complete exterioration of that truth. The activity of the first ray had also brought about an intense differentiation and crystallization among the nations and governments of the world. These two conditions of concrete orthodoxy and political differences persisted for many generations and are still manifesting. Today we have a similar condition both in the world of religion and in that of politics. This is true whether one is considering India or America, China or Germany, or whether one is studying the history of Buddhism with its many sects, Protestantism with its myriads of warring groups, or the many schools of philosophy in the Orient or the Occident. The condition is widespread and the public consciousness tremendously diversified, but this state of affairs marks the summation of the period of separativeness and the end, before so many centuries, of this intense distinctiveness of thought. After noting and watching this trend of affairs for another 100 years, the elder brothers of the race called a conclave of all departments about the year 1500 AD. Their object was to determine how the urge to integration, which is essentially the keynote of our universal order, could be hastened, and what steps could be taken to produce that synthesis and unification in the world of thought which would make possible the manifestation of the purpose of the divine life which had brought all into being. When the world of thought is unified, then the outer world will fall into a synthetic order. It should be remembered here that the masters think in large terms and work in the wider cycles of evolutionary endeavor. The tiny and temporary cycles, the small ebb and flow of the cosmic processes, do not engage their attention in the first instance. At this conclave, they had three things to do. First, to view the divine plan on as large a scale as possible and refresh their minds with the vision. Second, to note what influences or energies were available for use in the large endeavor to which they were pledged. Third, to train the men and women who were then probationers, chelas, and initiates, so that in due time they could have a satisfactory band of assistants on whom they could in future centuries rely. They had in connection with these aspirants two problems. One, they had to deal with the failure on the part of even the most advanced disciples to preserve continuity of consciousness, a failure even now manifested by even initiates. 2. The masters found the minds and brains of chelas curiously insensitive to the higher contacts, and this again is a condition which still prevails. The chelas, then as now, possessed aspiration, a desire to serve humanity, devotion, and occasionally a fair mental equipment, but that telepathic sensitivity, that instinctive response to hierarchical vibration, and that freedom from the lower psychism, which are the needed prerequisites to intensive intelligent work, were singularly lacking. For that matter, they are still distressingly so. Telepathic sensitivity is decidedly on the increase as a result of world conditions and the evolutionary trend, and this is, for the workers on the inner plane, a most encouraging sign. But love of psychic phenomena and failure to differentiate between the vibrations of the various grades of hierarchical workers still greatly hinder the work. You might here ask, and rightly so, what is this plan? When I speak of the plan, I do not mean such a general one as the plan of evolution or the plan for humanity, which we call by the somewhat unmeaning term of soul unfoldment. These two aspects of the scheme for our planet are taken for granted and are but modes, processes, and means to a specific end. The plan, as at present sensed, and for which the masters are steadily working, might be defined as follows. It is the production of a subjective synthesis in humanity and of a telepathic interplay which will eventually annihilate time. It will make available to every man all past achievements and knowledges. It will reveal to man the true significance of his mind and brain and make him the master of that equipment, and will make him therefore omnipresent and eventually open the door to omniscience. This next development of the plan will produce in man an understanding, intelligent and cooperative, of the divine purpose for which the one in whom we live and move and have our being has deemed it wise to submit to incarnation. Think not that I can tell of the plan as it truly is. It is not possible for any man below the grade of initiate of the third degree to glimpse it and far less understand it. The development of the mechanism whereby a disciple may be en rapport with those responsible for the working out of the plans, and a capacity to know, and not just dimly sense, that tiny aspect of the whole which is the immediate step ahead and with which cooperation is possible, that can be achieved by all disciples and should be held as the goal before all aspirants. With the exception of probationary disciples who are not as yet sufficiently stable in their endeavor, all can therefore strive towards achieving continuity of consciousness and at awakening that inner light which, when seen and intelligently used, will serve to reveal other aspects of the plan, and especially that one to which the illumined knower can respond and usefully serve. To bring this about has been the objective of all training given during the past 400 years, and from this fact you can vision the utter patience of the knowers of the race. They work slowly and with deliberation, free from any sense of speed, towards their objective, but, and herein lies the immediate interest of what I have to communicate, they do have a time limit. This is based upon the law of cycles. It concerns the operation of certain periods of opportunity which necessarily have their term. During these times of opportunity, forces, influences, and energies are temporarily at work, and of these the masters seek to make use. Looking ahead during the conclave to which I have made reference, the assembled servers of the race noted the future coming in of the Aquarian Age with its distinctive energies and its amazing opportunities. These they noted, and they sought to prepare man for that period which would approximate 2,500 years, and which could, if duly utilized, bring about the unification, consciously and intelligently, of mankind, and so produce the manifestation of what I prefer to call scientific brotherhood, in contradistinction to the sentimental connotation of the term now so prevalent. It appeared to them at that time that it would be necessary to do two things before the coming potencies of the Aquarian Age could profitably be employed. First of all, humanity must have its consciousness elevated to the mental plane. It must be expanded so that it included not only the world of emotion and of feeling, but also that of the intellect. The minds of men must be made widely and generally active, and the entire level of human intelligence must be raised. It was necessary, secondly, that something should be done to break down the barriers of separateness, of isolation, and of prejudice, which were keeping men apart from each other, and which they foresaw would increasingly do so. Cycle by cycle, men were becoming more and more wrapped up in their own selves, satisfaction and exclusiveness and racial pride. The result of this would lead inevitably to wide cleavages and the erection of world barriers between nation and nation and between race and race. This determination of the members of the hierarchy to train the minds of men more rapidly and to build towards a more synthetic unity brought them to a decision which involved the formation of group units and brought about the emergence of those groups of workers and thinkers who, through their activities, have so largely governed and molded our world for the past 3 or 4 centuries. We have, therefore, dating from this conclave, the inauguration of definite and specific group work along clearly defined lines, with each group standing for some peculiar presentation of truth and for some aspect of the knowledge of reality. These groups fall generally into 4 major divisions, cultural, political, religious, and scientific. In more modern times, 3 other groups have definitely emerged. They are the philosophical, the psychological, and the financial groups. Philosophers have, of course, always been with us, but they have been, for the most part, isolated units who have founded schools characterized by partisanship and separativeness. Now there are no outstanding figures as in the past, but groups who represent certain ideas. It is of profound importance that the work of these 7 groups of thinkers be recognized as part of the hierarchical program designed to produce a certain situation, to bring about certain preparatory conditions, and as playing a definite part in the work of world evolution as far as humanity is concerned. Under the influence of the different rays as they cycled in and out of activity, little groups of men emerged, played their part in group formation, and disappeared, often unaware of their inherent synthesis and of their co-workers. As can be seen in any intelligent historical retrospect, the work that they did for the race and their contribution to the pageant of the progress of mankind stands out with clarity. I have not the time to take this procession of groups, each custodian of a special contribution, and trace for you the work they did or the subjective impulses under which they worked. I can but indicate the trend of their endeavor and leave to some illumined student of history the delineation of the golden thread of their spiritual work as they raised the mental standard of the race and put man en rapport with the world in which he lived, opening his eyes not only to the nature of matter and of form, but also to the hidden depths of his own being. Through their activities, we now have a humanity in close relation, though not at one, and a humanity characterized by 3 things. 1. An amazing interrelation and intercommunication, of which the radio, the press, modern transportation, and the telephone and telegraph are the servants. 2. A widespread philanthropic enterprise and the growth of the sense of responsibility for one's brother, which was totally unknown in the year 1500. Movements such as the Red Cross, educational foundations, hospitals, and the present economic relief measures to be found in every country are its exoteric manifestations. 3. A division of the entire human family, consciously or unconsciously, into 2 basic groups. First, those who stand for the old order of things, who are reactionary and separative. They represent separative nationalism, boundaries, servitude, and servile obedience. They exemplify religious sectarianism and dependence upon authority. They are against all modern innovations and progress. Secondly, those who vision a unified world wherein love of God means love of one's neighbor, and where the motives underlying all religious, political, and educational activities are characterized by a world consciousness and the welfare of the entire body and not of the part. The unification to which the forward-looking people aspire does not involve the neglect of any part, but it does involve the care and nurture of each part in order that it may contribute to the well-being of the entire organism. It involves, for instance, the right government and proper development of every national unit so that it can adequately perform its international duties and thus form part of a world brotherhood of nations. This concept does not even involve the formation of a world state, but it does involve the development of a universal public consciousness which realizes the unity of the whole and thus produces the determination that each must be for all and all for each, as it has been said. Only in this way can there be brought about an international synthesis which will be characterized by political and national unselfishness. This universal state of mind will not again inevitably involve the founding of a world or a universal religion. It requires simply the recognition that all formulations of truth and of belief are only partial in time and space and are temporarily suited to the temperaments and conditions of the age and race. Those who favor some particular approach to the truth will nevertheless achieve the realization that other approaches and other modes of expression and terminologies and other ways of defining deity can be equally correct and in themselves constitute aspects of a truth which is greater and vaster than man's present equipment can grasp and express. Even the great ones themselves but dimly sense reality, and though they are aware of deeper underlying purposes than are their chelas, yet even they see not the ultimate goal. They too are forced to use such unmeaning terms in their teaching as absolute reality and ultimate realization. Hence, during the past 3 centuries, group after group has appeared and played its part, and we today reap the benefit of their accomplishment. Under the cultural group, for instance, we find emerging the poets of the Elizabethan age and the musicians of Germany and of the Victorian era. Groups of artists are likewise to be found, giving us the famous schools which are the glory of Europe. 2 famous groups, one cultural and the other political, also played their parts, the one producing the Renaissance and the other bringing about the French Revolution. The effects of their work are still to be felt. For the modern humanistic movement, with its emphasis upon the past, which is completed in the present, and its search for the roots of man's equipment in the earlier trends, harks back to the Renaissance. Revolution and the determination to fight for the divine rights of man find their prime inaugurating influence and impetus in the revolution in France. Revolt, the formation of political parties, the class warfare which is so rampant today, and the splitting of every country into warring political groups, though sporadic always, have become universal during the past 200 years, and are all the results of the group activities started by the masters. Men have grown thereby, and have learned how to think, and even though they may think wrongly, and may initiate disastrous experiments, the ultimate good is inevitable and unavoidable. Temporary discomforts, passing depressions, war and bloodshed, penury and vice may lead the unthinking into the depths of pessimism, but those who know and who sense the inner guiding hand of the hierarchy are aware that the heart of humanity is sound, and that out of the present chaos, and perhaps largely because of it, there will emerge those competent to deal with the situation and adequate to the task of unification and synthesis. This period has been occultly called the Age of Restoration of what has been broken by the Fall. The time has come when the separate parts can be reunited and the whole stand together again in its earlier perfection. The religious groups have likewise been many, so many that their enumeration is hopeless. We have the groups of Catholic mystics who are the glory of the Occident. There are also the protesting Lutherans, Calvinists, and Methodists, the Pilgrim Fathers, those sour and earnest men, the Huguenots and Moravian martyrs, and the thousands of modern sects in every group. These have all served their purpose and have led man to the point of revolt and away from acquiescence in authority. They have driven man to the stage of thinking for himself by the force of their unique example. They stood for freedom and the personal right to know. These latter groups have acted largely under the influence of the 6th and 2nd rays. The cultural emerged under that of the 4th ray, whilst the 1st ray has impelled the political activities which have brought such changes in the nations. Under the 5th and 3rd ray impulses, groups of scientific investigators have arisen, working with the forces and energies that constitute the divine life, dealing with the outer garment of God, searching from without towards the within, and demonstrating to man his essential unity with all creation and his relationship, intrinsic and vital, with all forms of life. The names of the individuals in any group are legion and of relatively no importance. It is the group and its interrelated work that counts. It is interesting to note that in the scientific group, the underlying unity is particularly noticeable, for its members are singularly free from sectarianism and selfish competition. This cannot be said of the religious and political groups. In relation to the many nations and the myriads of men on earth, these molding groups under the various divisions are few in number. Their personnel, their contribution to the growth of human expression, and their place in the plan can quite easily be traced. The point to be emphasized is that they have all been motivated from the inner subjective side of life. They have come forth under a divine urge and with a specific work to accomplish. They have all been composed in the primary stage of disciples and initiates of the lesser degrees. They have all been subjectively guided step by step by their own souls, which have in their turn been cooperating consciously with the hierarchy of knowers. This has been the case even when the individual man has been totally unaware himself of his place in the group and that group's divine mission. Let it be remembered also that there has not been a single failure, though again and again the individual has not been cognizant of success. The mark of these workers is that they build for posterity, that those who have followed them have failed, and that those who have responded to this work have not been true to the ideal is disastrously true, but the initial group has uniformly achieved. This surely negates pessimism and demonstrates the exceeding potency of the subjective activity. The three groups to which I earlier referred require a word of comment. Their work is curiously different to that of the other groups, and their ranks are recruited from all the ray groups, though the members of the third group, that of the financiers, are found primarily upon the seventh ray, that of ceremonial organization. In the order of their emergence, they are the groups of philosophers, psychologists, and businessmen. The group of philosophers of more modern date are already powerfully molding thought, whilst the ancient schools of Asiatic philosophers are just beginning to influence Western ideas. Through analysis, correlation, and synthesis, the thought power of man is developed and the abstract mind can be unified with the concrete. Through their work, therefore, that interesting sensitivity of man, with its three outstanding characteristics of instinct, intellect, and intuition, is brought to a condition of intelligent coordination. Instinct relates man to the animal world. Intellect unites him to his fellow men, whilst the intuition reveals to him the life of divinity. All these three are the subject matter of philosophical investigation, for the theme of the philosophers is the nature of reality and the means of knowledge. The two most modern groups are the psychologists who work under the Delphic injunction, "Man, know thyself," and the financiers who are the custodians of the means whereby man can live upon the physical plane. These two groups necessarily, and in spite of apparent divergences and differences, are more synthetic in their foundational aspects than any of the others. One group concerns itself with mankind, with the varying types of humanity, the mechanism employed, and man's urges, characteristics, and with the purpose, apparent or hidden, of his being. The other group controls and orders the means whereby he exists, controlling all that can be converted into energy and constituting a dictatorship over all modes of intercourse, commerce, and exchange. They control the multiplicity of form objects which modern man regards as essential to his mode of life. Money, as I have said before, is only crystallized energy or vitality, what the Oriental student calls pranic energy. It is a concretization of etheric force. It is therefore vital energy externalized, and this form of energy is under the direction of the financial group. They are the latest group in point of date, and their work, it should be borne in mind, is most definitely planned by the hierarchy. They are bringing about effects upon the earth which are most far-reaching. Now that centuries have elapsed since the conclave in the 16th century, these external groups have played their part and performed most notable service. The results achieved have reached a stage where they are internationally effective, and their influence is not confined to one nation or race. The hierarchy is now faced with another situation which requires careful handling. They must gather up and weld together the various threads of influencing energy and the differing trends of thought power which the work of the group since the year 1500 has produced. They have also now to offset some of the effects which are tending towards a further differentiation. This must inevitably be so when force is brought into contact with the material world. Initial impulses have in them potency both for good and for evil. As long as the form remains of secondary importance and relatively negligible, we call it good. Then the idea, and not its expression, controls. As time elapses and the energy of the thought makes its impact upon matter, and lesser minds seize upon the particular type of energy or are vitalized by it, then evil begins to make its presence felt. This finally demonstrates as selfishness, separateness, pride, and those characteristics which have produced so much harm in the world. About 17 years ago, the masters met and came to a momentous decision. Just as it had been decided at the earlier conclave to gather out of the inchoate masses of men, groups of workers along various lines, and set them the task of elevating humanity and expanding the human consciousness, so now it was felt wise to gather out of the many groups, a group which should contain, as does the hierarchy itself, men of all races, of all types and tendencies. This group has a specific mission, and some of the facts about it might be stated as follows. It is, first of all, an attempt at an externalization of the hierarchy upon the physical plane, or a small working replica of this essentially subjective body. Its members are all in physical bodies, but must work entirely subjectively, thus utilizing the inner sensitive apparatus and the intuition. It is to be composed of men and women of all nations and ages, but each one must be spiritually oriented, all must be conscious servers, all must be mentally polarized and alert, and all must be inclusive. One of the essential conditions imposed upon the personnel of the group is that they must be willing to work without recognition on the subjective levels. They must work behind the scenes as do the great ones. Its members, therefore, must be free from all taint of ambition and from all pride of race and of accomplishment. They must be also sensitively aware of their fellow men and of their thoughts and conditioning environment. It is a group that has no exoteric organization of any kind, no headquarters, no publicity, no group name. It is a band of obedient workers and servers of the word, obedient to their own souls and to group need. All true servers everywhere, therefore, belong to this group, whether their line of service is cultural, political, scientific, religious, philosophical, psychological, or financial. They constitute part of the inner group of workers for humanity and of the world mystics, whether they know it or not. They will be thus recognized by their fellow group members when contacted in the casual ways of world intercourse. This group gives to the word spiritual a wide significance. They believe it to mean an inclusive endeavor towards human betterment, uplift, and understanding. They give it the connotation of tolerance, international synthetic communion, religious inclusiveness, and all trends of thought which concern the esoteric development of the human being. It is a group, therefore, without a terminology or Bible of any kind. It has no creed nor any dogmatic formulations of truth. The motivating impulse of each and all is love of God as it works out in love for one's fellow man. They know the true meaning of brotherhood without distinction of race. Their lives are lives of willing service, rendered with utter selflessness and without any reservations. The personnel of the group is known only to the elder brothers of the race, and no register of names is kept, and there are only three main requirements. 1. A certain amount of at-one-ment between the soul and its mechanism is essential, and that inner triplicity, usually dormant in the majority of soul, mind, brain, must be in alignment and active. 2. The brain has to be telepathically sensitive in two directions and at will. It must be aware of the world of souls and also of the world of men. 3. There must also exist a capacity for abstract or synthetic thought. This will enable a man to leap over racial and religious barriers. When this is present, also, there is an assured belief in the continuity of life and its correlation to the life after death. To sum up the situation, it must be noted that the groups in the past have stood for certain aspects of truth and have demonstrated certain ray characteristics. The new group will express all the aspects and have in it members on all the rays. The majority of the workers in the many groups have carried forward certain details of the plan and added their quota of energy to the forward urge of humanity, but they have for the most part done this without any true understanding of what they were accomplishing and without any real comprehension of that body-soul relationship which leads to really intelligent work, unless we except a few prominent mystics such as Meister Eckhart. They have been primarily groups of personalities with that added touch of genius which indicates a certain contact with the soul. The group that is now in process of formation is composed of those who are aware of the fact of the soul and have established a soul intercourse that is real and lasting. They look upon the mind, emotions, and body nature as simply an equipment whereby human contacts can be established, and their work, as they see it, is to be carried forward through the medium of this equipment acting under the direction of the soul. They are therefore living souls working through personalities and not personalities actuated by occasional soul impulses. The members of the many groups were all somewhat one-sided and their talents ran along some specific line. They demonstrated a capacity to write as Shakespeare, to paint like a Da Vinci, to produce musical masterpieces like a Beethoven, or to bring about world changes like Napoleon. But the new type of group worker is a rounded-out individual with a capacity to do almost anything to which he sets his hand, but with a basic impulse to work on thought levels more than on the physical plane. He is therefore of use to the hierarchy, as he can be used in a variety of ways, for his flexibility and experience and his stability of contact can be all subordinated to the group requirements. The true exponent of this new group type will, of course, not appear for many decades. He will be a true Aquarian with a universal touch, an intense sensitivity, a highly organized mental apparatus, an astral equipment which is primarily responsive to the higher spiritual vibrations, a powerful and controlled energy body, and a sound physical body, though not robust in the ordinary use of the term. What, then, is the present situation in connection with the integrating group of mystics? Let me be somewhat explicit. In every European country, in the United States of America, and in parts of Asia and South Africa, are to be found certain disciples, usually unrecognized by the world at large, who are thinking truth. Let me call your attention to that phrase. The most important workers in this new group and those who are closest to the great ones are those whose daily thought life is oriented by the new ideal. That this thought life of theirs may work out in definite exoteric activities may be true, but they are, first of all and always, those who live in and work from the high and secret place. Their influence is wielded silently and quietly, and they lay no emphasis upon their personalities, upon their own views and ideas, or upon their methods of carrying forward the work. They possess a full realization of their own limitations, but are not handicapped thereby, but proceed to think through into objective manifestation that aspect of the vision which it is their mission to vivify into form. They are necessarily cultured and widely read, for in these difficult transitional times they have to cultivate a world grasp of conditions and possess a general idea of what is going on in the different countries. They possess, in truth, no nationality in the sense that they regard their country and their political affiliations as of paramount importance. They are equipped to organize, slowly and steadily, that public opinion which will eventually divorce man from religious sectarianism, national exclusiveness, and racial biases. One by one, here and there, they are being gathered out and are gathering to them those who are free from the limitations of past political, religious, and cultural theories. They, the members of the one group, are organizing these forward-looking souls into groups which are destined to bring in the new era of peace and of goodwill. These latter, who are being influenced by the group members, are as yet only a few thousands among the millions of men, and out of the 400 accepted disciples working in the world at this time, only about 156 are equipped by their thought activity to form part of this slowly forming group. These constitute the nucleus of what will be someday a dominant force. During the next 25 years, their influence will become potent enough to attract political attention, provided those of you who have seen the vision of a powerful, subjective body of thinking souls can speak the needed words and outline those concepts which will hasten the work of integration and put the units in this group in touch with one another. Do your utmost to see that this is done and make this the message and keynote of the work you all do wherever you are. What should therefore be the work of the immediate present? Let me outline the program as far as I can. The first thing to be done is to strengthen the ties and establish firmly the link between yourselves and all those whom you recognize as possible working disciples in the new group. To do this, acquaint yourselves with the work of the leaders of groups in the various countries of the world, such as Switzerland, the United States, Holland, Germany, and Great Britain. From their reaction to the vision of this new age type of work, you can then make a temporary decision. Watch them at their work. Note the emphasis laid by them upon personalities. If personal ambition seems to govern their activities, if their position is one of a determination to work in the group of mystics because of its novelty, or because it gives them a certain standing, or because it intrigues their imagination or gives them scope for gathering people around them, then proceed no further, but, preserving silence, leave time and the law to correct their attitude. Secondly, be receptive towards those who seek you out and seem to vibrate to the same note. When I say you, I mean the group to which you all subjectively belong. They will come if you work with decision and sound out the note of unity so clearly that they are in no doubt as to your motives and your disinterested activity. Some of the 156 who form the present nucleus will be known to you and will work in unison with you, though maybe not in your peculiar field of action. The picture to be held before your eyes is that of a vast network of groups working along the many possible lines, but having at their heart or behind them, working silently and persistently influencing through soul contact, one or more members of the new, slowly emerging group. These focal points through which the hierarchy is now seeking to work stand together telepathically, and exoterically they must work in the completest understanding, preserving always an attitude of non-interference and leaving each worker free to teach his own group as he sees fit. The terms used, the methods employed, the types reached, the truths taught, the discipline of life demonstrated concern no one but the working disciple. The members of this group of New Age workers will, however, possess certain general characteristics. They will impose no enforced dogmas of any kind, and will lay no emphasis upon any doctrine or authorities. They are not interested in having any personal authority, nor do they rest back upon traditional authority, whether religious, scientific, cultural, or any other form of imposed truth. Modes of approach to reality will be recognized, and each will be free to choose his own. No discipline will be imposed by these workers upon those who seek to cooperate with them. The ideas of any one person or leader as to how the units in his particular sphere of activity should live and work, should meditate and eat, will be regarded as of no special value. The members of this new group work esoterically with souls and deal not with the details of the personality lives of the aspirants they seek to inspire. This is a basic rule and will serve to eliminate many worthy aspirants from this group of world service now in process of forming. The tendency to impose one's own point of view indicates a lack of understanding, and it will rule many out. Again, the young and promising aspirants must be sought out and carefully inculcated with the trend of the new ideals. They must be taught to look for the divine and the good in all, both people and circumstances. Breadth of vision must be developed, and that wide horizon pointed out, which will enable the aspirants to live through this transitional period which is now with us, so that when they reach middle life, they will stand as pillars of strength in the new world. Do not narrow them down to the ancient disciplines, and teach them not to lay emphasis upon diet, celibacy, times and seasons, and so distract their attention away from the newer and sacred art of being and the wonder of living as a soul. Forget not that when a man is living as a soul, and his entire personality is therefore subordinated to that soul, unselfish purpose, purity of life, conformity to law, and the setting of a true example of spiritual living will normally and automatically follow. Food, for instance, is frequently a matter of climatic expediency and of taste, and that food is desirable which keeps the physical body in condition to serve the race. Again, a divine son of God can surely function as freely and as effectively when in the married state as in the celibate. He will, however, brook no prostitution of the powers of the body to the grosser satisfactions, nor will he offend against established custom, nor lower the standard which the world has set for its highest and best. The issues have been confused, and the emphasis has been too often laid upon the physical acts and not upon the life of the actor. When the attention is fixed upon the soul, the physical plane life will be rightly handled. It will be realized that there is greater hindrance to the growth of the man in spiritual being through a critical attitude or a state of self-satisfaction than by the eating of meat. Two rules of life activity must be taught the young aspirant. He must be taught to focus on constructive activity and to refrain from pulling down the old order of living. He must be set to building for the future and to thinking along the new lines. He must be warned not to waste time in attacking that which is undesirable, but must instead bend all his energies to creating the new temple of the Lord through which the glory may be manifested. In this way, public attention will gradually be focused upon the new and beautiful, and the old established creations will fall into decay for lack of attention and so disappear. He must be taught also that partisanship is in no way a sign of spiritual development. He will not therefore use the words anti this or pro that. Such terms automatically breed hatred and attack and effort to resist change. They put the user on the defensive. Every class of human beings is a group of brothers. Catholics, Jews, Gentiles, Occidentals, and Orientals are all the sons of God. As regards the future of this world group of which we have been speaking, much depends upon two things. First, it is necessary for all those isolated disciples working in every country in the world to become aware of one another and then to enter into telepathic rapport. This may seem to you to be a wonderful but impractical vision. I assure you that this is not so. The work of establishing this rapport may indeed be slow, but it is an inevitable effect of the growing sensitivity of all the souls who are working in the field of the world. The first indication of it is that instinctive recognition of those who constitute part of this group when they meet and contact each other in the ways of world intercourse. There comes to them an immediate flashing forth of the light, an instantaneous electrical interplay, a sudden sensing of a similarity of vision and of objective, or a vital opportunity to aid in and to cooperate with each other in the work in which it is realized that all are interested. Working disciples everywhere, when they meet each other, will know at once that their work is identical and will advise with each other as to where cooperation and supplementary endeavor may be possible. In about 30 years, the interrelation between the units in this group, scattered as they may be all over the world, will be so close that daily they will meet each other at a set time and in the secret place. This only becomes possible when the triplicity of soul, mind, brain are all aligned in the individual, and when each aspect of it can be simultaneously in touch with members of the group. At present, all the souls of the group of mystics do work in unison. A number have succeeded in bringing the soul and the mind also into a close and established relation. But as yet, the lowest aspect of this aligned and linking triangle, the physical brain, remains totally unresponsive to the waves of force emanating from the higher aspects of the disciples engaged thus in laying the foundations of the New Age civilization. It is therefore largely a matter of perfecting the mechanism of the brain so that it can rightly register and correctly transmit the soul impressions and the group purposes and recognitions. This involves, 1, the awakening into conscious activity of the center between the eyebrows, called by the Oriental student the Ajna center. 2, the subordinating then of the activity of this center to that of the head center, so that the two vibrate in unison. This produces the establishment of 3 things. A, direct conscious alignment between soul, mind, brain. B. The appearance of a magnetic field which embraces both the head centers and so definitely affects the pineal gland and the pituitary body. C. The recognition of this field of dual activity in two ways, as of a light in the head, an interior radiant sun, or as a dynamic center of energy through which the will or purpose aspect of the soul can make itself felt. 3. The development of a facility which will enable a man to A. use the mind in any direction he chooses, turning it externally towards the world of phenomena or internally towards the world of spiritual being.